This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. So how long does it take you to commute to work? The national average is about 25 minutes, although if you live in places like San Francisco or New York or Atlanta or other congested cities, it can take much, much longer. So it's not surprising that commuting ranks right up there or down there with housework as one of Americans' least favorite activities. Coming up, how to make that time more enjoyable. But first, Richard Rise joins us. He's a senior editor at Philadelphia Magazine and ranted in this month's issue of the magazine about SEPTA's quiet ride cars on the regional rail line, the piece called Hell is Other People on the SEPTA quiet ride car. And Richard Rise, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And you take the train to Norristown.
Yes, I do.
And do you regularly take the quiet car?
I try to, but it's probably not for the best of my mental health.
Yeah. Well, tell us, I guess, what the rules and regulations are for the quiet ride car. How is it supposed to be?
Essentially, you are not supposed to use your cell phone. You're supposed to keep all conversations very brief and to an absolute minimum. And otherwise, no audio devices, use your headphones, you know, sort of general common courtesy.
And from your experience, and I get the feeling, I don't know how, is this an everyday kind of occurrence where people are yapping on their cell phones and having loud conversations with their seatmate?
I wouldn't say every day, but more often than I would like, and I think most people that take the quiet car would like. And then that just leads to a lot of other issues in terms of how they enforce the rules and those things.
In fact, one of the things you say in the piece is that it's kind of either people have to police themselves or it's up to people like you, the passengers, who police the quiet ride car.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's sort of the rules, quote unquote, are very loosely enforced. So the conductors are supposed to make announcements. Some are better at that than others. But from its inception, it's always been thought that you, as the passenger, are going to take some responsibility. And that's where a lot of the problems lie. And in the piece, I sort of break down the types of passengers in the car, and one of them being the enforcers, the vigilantes, who take it upon themselves to quiet down folks who aren't being otherwise so observant of the rules.
In fact, you have the lemmings who just sort of sit there and stew and kind of grin and bear it.
Yes.
The group you described as the jazz hands, who are just rolling their eyes and all the body language, but they don't say anything.
Right.
And then the vigilantes. Which one are you then?
I would probably admittedly, I have my share of jazz hands days just because the stress of confronting someone, as politely as you may do it, oftentimes people are apologetic and they're quiet, but it only takes that one person who tells you, turn around, buddy, to then really escalate it to a level that no one wants to be involved in. But I do have my vigilante moments where I'll just turn and say, excuse me, it's the quiet car. And sometimes that doesn't work out.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Richard Rise, again, senior editor at Philadelphia Magazine. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about commuting to and from work. And if you ride the quiet car, the regional rail system here in Philadelphia, and want to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscoane, and we will read those on the air. Your article in the Philadelphia Magazine begins with about a girl in a bright orange tank top. Obviously, this was the summer, but what happened?
She got on with a friend, and the two of them sort of chatting away. And as I was getting frustrated, and a number of other people were frustrated, I eventually saw a youngish man who had headphones in take them out and say, excuse me, this is the quiet car. And they just sort of seemed puzzled at the concept and continued to talk. What I found myself doing just sort of to amuse myself was sending out tweets that said, today on SEPTA's quiet ride car, a couple gets on and yaps about their mortgage payments. And as I kept doing this, I realized I've got enough of these that we could actually put together a piece. So the examples run the gamut from, you know, the benign to full-on explosive events where...
I mean, true confrontations, would you say?
Yeah, one that I didn't witness, but it was described to me by one of the conductors. A gentleman would not stop talking. The conductor pleaded with him to be quiet. Some other passengers got involved, and he referred to a woman as livestock, which then sparked a number of people to get up out of their seats, and someone challenged him to get off at the next stop and talk about this on the platform, and it turned into a total circus.
Well, and I think one of the operative words is there is conductor. I mean, the conductors are supposed to essentially monitor and keep the peace and deal with the rules and regulations of the quiet ride car.
Yes, they're supposed to, and some are better than others. I suspect that some of them just don't want the confrontation themselves. They'll make one announcement very early on, and that's it. Some of them are really great about it, and they have, you know, they're just those kind of people that can talk to people and diffuse situations, and they're excellent. But part of the problem is that, again, the rules as they are very loosely enforced. You know, I was on a train one Friday evening, and the head conductor had just decided it's Friday evening. It's probably going to get a little rowdy. Let's not enforce the quiet rules out of the blue. And I mean, that becomes a problem because then people just don't know what to expect. And if you've got to ask, and you know, there's this constant question as to are we on the quiet ride? Are we not on the quiet ride? It just gets things even more convoluted.
Well, and I guess the thinking behind the quiet ride car is not just quiet, but that people can kind of decompress after work or going to work and feel the sort of lack of stress that they might feel in other parts of their life. But it sounds like when people disobey the rules of the quiet ride car, the stress level goes up.
Yeah, it's this really strange phenomenon where, I mean, I'm one of those people that I like to turn a fan on at night just to have some sort of constant noise rather than the infrequent burst of disruptive noise. So logically, you would think I would just get onto the other cars.
Yes, exactly.
Because there would be the constant din that would sort of – I'd be able to just tune all of that out. But I sort of say in the piece, you know, that if you promise me this nirvana of silence, I'm going to keep looking for it. So I keep getting on thinking – It will just be that zen place.
Just
where
that one day out of the week when it's quiet.
50 minutes, you know, at the end of the day where I can just read the paper or a really bad book and do it in silence, but it doesn't work out that way.
Well, and I have to say, I take a different train line, but I have to say the train line I'm on, people mostly obey it. And it tends to be the same people, so I think they know what the rules and regulations are. I often think it's people, they just don't know. You hear an announcement, but it doesn't really penetrate.
Yeah, well, and that's what I've found. One, that it really does depend on which line you take.
And ours is the best line, for sure.
Well, clearly. It sounds like you know your conductor on a first-name basis, and everyone's very
social,
and
you're
having potluck dinners together.
Practically.
And that is not my experience, for sure. And then just a matter of the types of passengers, you know. And again, and that's where you feel guilt as a vigilante type on the quiet car because, you know, you see an older couple get on, and they're going to the flower show, and they just don't know.
Right.
A younger couple with some kids that's going in for something in the city. Again, they don't know, but that noise still drives you crazy nonetheless. So it's sort of it's a lose-lose for everyone.
So what do you want SEPTA to do about this?
I think it would be helpful if they just came up with a clear set of rules and put maybe a little more of the emphasis on the conductor enforcement. I know those guys have and women have a tough job. There's a lot to manage, especially during rush hour. But maybe being a little more consistent with the rules they have, and you know they do have these cards that they hand out.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Have the rules which is a really smart way to diffuse things. If someone thinks you're making this up or you're picking on me or something, they can just hand them a card very discreetly and say, you know, here's an outline of what the rules are. So maybe make the rules a little more clear and be a little more active with that kind of subtle, sleight of hand pass of the explanation.
How about a major announcement on the loudspeaker system, which doesn't always work on a SEPTA train, but nonetheless.
Yeah, and often people are just in their own world and the announcement comes, and if you're already talking, you didn't hear it, right? So that's a problem too. But, you know, or maybe we just all sit in the back of the train and not worry about this.
And not worry about it. Actually, we have Holly calling us from, looks like, Middletown, Delaware. And Holly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marie. I'm glad you guys are talking about this. I travel on Amtrak twice a month, I guess, up to New York. And I take a very early morning train up there and a fairly late train back. And I am an avid rider of the quiet car. And I noticed that when people, when they offend and don't follow the quiet car rules, they kind of break down into two separate groups. I've noticed that there are people who are just rude.
Yes.
And they tend to be younger people, unfortunately. And I hate to sound like an old person. but the other group is like guys who'll get on their cell phones and start talking. And then all of us, like this whole, you know, all these heads will pop up like little
gophers?
Groundhogs.
Yeah, that's right.
And there are lemurs. Like, what are you doing? Why are you talking? And then they'll say, oh, I'm sorry. And they'll continue their phone conversation either thinking that they're talking quietly, although they have no voice modulation, or they continue talking loudly for two more minutes just to say, well, I'm still in the quiet car and I got to get off the phone. And it's almost humorous, but we really, really crave that quiet on the quiet car.
Well, Holly, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Richard a chance to respond.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen that too. It oftentimes, I think when you do sort of shame someone into acknowledging that they're in the wrong car to be talking, they do need to give you that 60 seconds more just to let you know that they're still in control, and then they usually quiet down. But I was just on Amtrak recently and had a group of business people right behind me, and the woman next to me turned to them and said, excuse me, it's the quiet ride car. Please pipe down. And they got quiet. They looked very offended.
Oh.
The second she got off the train, they started talking again. And we still had 40 minutes to go. So I perhaps unwisely turned around and just said, you know, It's still the quiet car, even though she
And what did they do about that?
This woman said to me, you have nothing better to do than worry about this. Oh. And I said, well, I wouldn't be so worried if you could let me think about other more important things in peace.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but I also wonder whether there's a technological fix, which is when you speak into your cell phone, you don't know how loud you are.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you don't get the kind of feedback in your ear that tells you you're being really loud, and people have no idea how loud they are on the train.
It's like someone on the phone in an elevator, and it's like that your phone voice is loud. When you said a technological fix, I thought maybe you were thinking of some sort of shot collar or a remote buzzer
maybe
we
so.
Could use. That would also work.
So is this going to be your mission in life, Richard Rise, to have some peace and quiet on the quiet car?
I'm trying to ease my way out of this and take the talking friendly car a little more often, just for my own stress relief.
Sanity.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marie.
You're very welcome. Richard Rise, senior editor at Philadelphia Magazine, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Coming up, we'll be talking about why it might make you happier and healthier to talk to people sitting next to you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We were just talking about how unquiet the quiet cars can be on SEPTA's regional rail lines. Now we want to talk about how socializing on public transit can make the ride more enjoyable, how talking with strangers could maybe make you even happy. Joining us is Nicholas Epley, and he's a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, author of a book called Mindwise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And Nicholas Epley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, to join this portion of the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Before I talk about some of your research, I'm curious about your thoughts about quiet ride cars. They have them here on regional rail in the Philadelphia area, but it's true on Amtrak as well. Do you have a position on quiet ride cars?
I do. So we have them here in Chicago too. In fact, just after we collected our data that I'm about to talk to you about, they rolled out the quiet car policy because they had asked people what they wanted, and they said they wanted some peace and quiet. I don't have any I don't have any strong position on it per se, except that what we find in our data is that actually engaging a stranger in conversation might be surprisingly pleasant.
Well, in fact, tell us about the research that you did, how you ran that experiment.
Yeah, so what we were interested in is why do strangers who are in close proximity to each other so routinely ignore each other? Why is it, as the most social species on the planet, we sit next to each other and barely converse? You see that in trains and waiting rooms, any big city downtown, over and over again. And so what we did was we tested first in an experiment, to see whether talking to a stranger might actually be unpleasant. And so people are being rational and sensible by not doing this. And so what we did was we had commuters on the way into Chicago on one of our train lines. We also ran this in buses in downtown Chicago and in cabs leaving Midway Airport and in a waiting room that we created as well. What we did is we had commuters who were interested in participating in the study. We randomly assigned them to one of three experimental conditions. In one condition, we told them just to sit there and enjoy their solitude today. In another condition, we told them to do whatever they normally do, and that's usually to just sit there and enjoy their solitude.
Right.
And in the third condition, we asked them to try to form a connection with the person who sat down next to them today, somebody else on the train, talk to a stranger. At the end of the commute, they filled out a survey for us, and we asked them how happy they were, how sad they were, how pleasant their commute was, a bunch of other questions too, but those were the three we were most interested in. We averaged those into a composite of how positive the experience was, and what we found was that those who were randomly assigned to the connection condition reported being significantly happier than those who were in the solitude condition.
So what did they talk about?
We don't really know exactly. We didn't obviously record their conversations. We did ask them to write down what they talked about, and it was nothing miraculous. It was there was no deep-seated connection, no revealing of deep secrets or anything like that. It was mainly small talk, but you created some connection with this person. You engaged somebody else sitting there next to you, and that seemed to be surprisingly pleasant for people. Or at least pleasant for people.
Well, was it pleasant for the stranger that they were talking to?
Well, that's hard to tell in an experiment, right? Because you can imagine you had people, like were on the quiet car, and they would rather not have you blabbing at them for the 40 minutes. So you could be spreading misery to other people. You're yourself happy, but you're making this dude miserable.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah. We don't think that's going on, but we don't know in these experiments because for ethical reasons, we can't run. So if you and I, Marty, got on the train, I sat down next to you and I started talking to you, I would have filled out informed consent to be in the experiment, but
right.
You didn't.
Right.
And so I can't question you. So in order to find that out, what we had to do was we had to run an experiment where we created a situation where both people were in the experiment. And so we could survey both of them. And that's what we did when we created kind of a waiting room in downtown, in a lab that we have there. We had people wait for 10 minutes. Both of them were in the experiment. And we, in the midst of another experiment we were doing, we had one person who we instructed either try to form a connection to the other person sitting in the waiting room right now, or just sit and enjoy your solitude. At the end of the waiting period, we then asked both people how pleasant that waiting period was, and we found that both people were happier when they talked with each other than when they didn't.
Well, if you sat down next to me and I was commuting back and forth from work, I would probably say, cold weather today, I'm glad it's Thanksgiving, it's a short week. I mean, little chit-chatty kind of things. But that's probably all I would want to talk to you about.
Maybe. Although, here's the thing that's difficult to do. It's difficult to predict how we would behave in situations we're not in. And so we find that in our train experiences, too, and in our buses downtown and in the cabs as well. We ran other experiments where we asked people to predict how they would feel in these situations. So we asked them to predict how happy they would be if we randomly assigned them to sit and enjoy their solitude, how happy they would be if they did whatever they normally did, and how happy they would be if they actually engaged a stranger in conversation. And in direct contrast to what we actually found when we asked people to do this for real, people predicted that they would be happiest if they just sat there and enjoyed their solitude, and that they would be the least happy if they engaged in conversation with somebody. And so it's hard to forecast how you would feel in a situation that you're not actually in. And I bet you'd be surprised, Marty, that if I started talking with you and I asked you, you know, how are things going today? How long have you lived in Philadelphia? What do you do for a living? We'd go on for a very long time, I suspect.
Well, and this is not just about me during this hour, but I use my commute to do my homework, frankly, to prepare for this morning's interview with you, for instance.
I'm not
challenging or criticizing or in any way arguing with you, but I also think that commuting time is a time we're so social, at least at work and most people's jobs. At home, there are all these responsibilities with children and partners and dogs and cats and things. It's just nice to have, you know, half an hour where it's just yourself.
Oh, for sure. So we found that people's predictions about these experiences were very strong, and they predicted exactly what you're saying, that that I'd be more productive if I enjoyed my solitude, did whatever I normally do, than if I talked, and that I would be happier if I sat in solitude than if I talked. All I can say is that in our data, when we actually had people do this, they were surprised that the results looked like they would have turned out the opposite way. And it's, you know, our data don't suggest that you should talk to everybody at all times. Certainly not. I enjoy my solitude as much as anybody, perhaps even more. I like being outdoors in the woods a lot, and that's often time alone. But our data do suggest that when you're in the company of strangers, it might be surprisingly pleasant to just say hi. You know, you don't have to have a super long conversation, but you might be surprised what you find out if you open yourself up and just try to connect with somebody. It certainly is true that work can be a bit of a zero-sum game, although we didn't find any effects in our experiments on reported differences in reported productivity across the conditions. People just perhaps don't get as much work done on the trains as they might imagine. But our data don't suggest you need to spend the whole hour talking or the entire amount of time. I suspect just engaging in just a little hello, just opening yourself up and introducing yourself to this person momentarily might produce a meaningful boost too, in that moment.
And I'm now going to completely contradict myself because I take an early morning train on my train line with maybe the best conductor in the world, and it is a happy, special moment. And I'm not part of the sort of larger conversation. A lot of it is about sports, but it makes me happy that people are engaging with each other. So I just contradicted myself.
Yeah, look, I mean, so what you don't know, so if you sit down next to somebody on a train, so if I sit down next to you, Marty, on the train, you're sitting there working, you don't look interested in talking with me, and maybe you don't even look like that much of an interesting person, frankly. The average person doesn't look like that interesting, but that's because you don't know what interesting things they might have to tell you, stuff that you wouldn't know if you didn't engage them in conversation. And so you'll often find some just really surprising stuff. I was in Miami not that long ago, and my cab driver was somebody who had come over on a homemade boat from Cuba. His story was just unbelievable. And this guy just looked like any normal person.
Sure.
Just unbelievable. You don't always have those kinds of really impactful conversations with people, but you'd be surprised. At least our data suggests you would be surprised at how pleasant it could be.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers and some folks in on the conversation. That's Nicholas Epley. He's a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Wrote a book called Mind Wise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want, and has been doing some really fascinating research about talking to strangers on trains or subways or during that morning or afternoon commute. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Michael from, looks like, Cape May Courthouse joining us. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thanks. I'm a blind individual, and growing up in Center City, Philadelphia, and riding the buses, I always enjoyed, even during decompression, I enjoyed the bus because of the interpersonal relationships. Even if I didn't feel like talking, I could eavesdrop in on the conversations and smile enormously. Lived in Seattle, we'd get on the bus, and I'd ask my wife, Teresa, why we weren't sitting, and she said, because the bus is packed. I would have no idea the bus was packed because I couldn't even hear breathing. And yet 50 people would be in this. And there's a reason, I guess, with all the coffee they need to drink in that environment of such cloudiness, but people.
Well, Michael, let me take your essential point. I think it's fascinating as he described himself. He's somebody who is blind, but he gets to eavesdrop on all these conversations, and that is one of the benefits of being in a crowded bus.
Yeah, that's true. You get to hear other interesting conversations, perhaps even if you're not part of it. And I do, by the way, think that's also one of the reasons why conversation on trains can sometimes be frustrating, or even in buses now that there are cell phones. You don't get the benefit that your caller just mentioned, that Michael just mentioned, being able to hear a conversation when you only hear one side of it. Those are not dialogues. Those are what psychologists refer to as half-a-logs, and people do not like those. That's not nearly as pleasant as being able to hear a regular conversation, even if perhaps you're not in it.
I mean, we truly actively do not like that because we only get half of the conversation.
It's annoying, yeah. Yeah.
And science.
I think that's what the quiet car is really meant to try to to undo, is the talking on cell phones as much as anything else.
And does talking on cell phones, does it give us that same kind of social interaction that human beings crave and need and want so much?
That's a hard thing to answer. What I'll say now is that I don't think we know the answer to that correctly.
It's just too early to know that.
I think so.
All right.
It's a complicated answer.
Yeah. And I want to pick up on one other thing that you said about, and something that you wrote about as well, which is even just a nice, friendly eye contact with someone on the street, that even that little momentary connection can make people feel better.
Yeah, so this was an interesting experiment that was done by Kip Williams and his colleagues at Purdue University. And they found that essentially being acknowledged, having somebody look you in the eyes versus ignore you and not look you in the eyes, produces a meaningful boost to people's sense of well-being. And I don't think that's horribly shocking. Being ignored, being ostracized, being isolated, being disconnected from other people is one of the more unpleasant things in people's lives. And if that's chronic, that's, of course, a real danger to your to your health and to your well-being. What we find in our experiments, though, is just even little momentary conversations with people, just little bits of engagement can take a moment that's otherwise not so pleasant and make it even a little bit better.
Let me see what Joan from Mount Airy has to say. Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a story that actually confirms you, Marty, in that you get work done and also the researcher's findings. I wasn't on a commute. I was on a long plane trip, and I had the luxury of having a seat in between. So it was just me and this other woman in the end aisle seat, and we were about the same age, and she seemed very pleasant, and she had an accent, and I study immigration and ethnicity, so I was interested, but I had to get work done. So I was preparing for a conference, and I avoided talking to her, although I'm a very social person. But then towards the end of the plane ride, I was done with my paper, and I started talking with her, and it was a very satisfying conversation for both of us, and we acknowledged it and ended up exchanging phone numbers because she turned out that her background was what I was with her mother was exactly what I was presenting on at the conference.
Oh, wow.
So it was just serendipity. You know, but it was just turned out to be the most pleasant conversation. Well, so, it confirms both your experience and the researcher's findings.
Well, Joan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Nicholas Epley, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, she talks about these sort of serendipitous moments.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, but it's also easy to underestimate how much serendipity there is out there. So Joan had this really interesting connection with the person sitting next to her on the train, and it seems like that's maybe the only, you know, that's really an amazing and unique connection, and it is. Mm-hmm. But think about the number of attributes you have about yourself, the number of interesting facts that you have, any of those facts or features about yourself could connect to almost anyone. And the thing about conversation is that it's a bit like a heat-seeking missile, where two people in conversation, particularly with strangers, very quickly try to find, if you have a meaningful conversation, very quickly try to find the things that you have in common. And that means you're probably going to pretty quickly find out you have more in common with somebody, mm-hmm. just random stranger sitting next to you, than you might imagine.
What do you think the resistance is? I was thinking of that stranger danger, danger stranger. I mean, it's often told to children, but what is the resistance to interacting with a stranger?
Well, we find, at least in our experiments, that it seems to be a fear of rejection. So if we ask people on the trains what percentage of people would be willing to talk to you today, they say in the lower 40% number on average. They say about 42% of people on the train would be willing to talk to me. You know, they're sitting there, they're doing their work, they're looking at their iPad, whatever, they're not, don't seem interested in you. What percentage of people would actually be willing to talk to you if you tried? Much closer to 100%, as far as we can tell. And that is, we've never had a person who reported in our experiments trying to talk to the person next to them and being totally rebuffed. Now, of course, that happens in life. You know, people don't want to engage in conversation with you, particularly at certain times. But at least in these contexts, people seem to underestimate how social other people are and how interested other people would be in engaging you in conversation if just you tried.
We are almost out of time here, but are you a naturally sociable person? I mean, someone who would naturally, without being part of an experiment, strike up a conversation with a stranger?
So I'm pretty social, but I did not used to talk to people on the train or on planes like I do now. And in fact, I got rid of my smartphone in favor of a stupid phone, one that just makes calls, because I felt it was just keeping me too disengaged from other people, and I thought that I was missing out on stuff, you know, on friendly neighbors that I had just nearby because I was distracted by other things. And that came right from our data. That wasn't something that I was naturally inclined to do.
Well, a lot of fun talking to you, Nicholas Epley. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, author of a book called MindWise. We have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about the dangers of distracted driving. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. We all know that distracted drivers are dangerous. Who hasn't seen a motorist on a cell phone running a red light? And while most states ban texting while driving, cars are increasingly full of distracting devices. Matt Richtel's book, A Deadly Wandering, is a cautionary tale about inattention on the road. He's a reporter for the New York Times. In fact, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his New York Times series of articles on distracted driving. And Matt Richtel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. And I just want to say that conversation you had really resonated. I have... I walk around and watch people's faces down in their phones, and I'm gregarious. I always want to talk to someone. There's no one left.
Well, this is why you're on the radio with us. We get to talk.
Finally, someone will listen to me.
We get to ask you a bunch of questions. And let me just talk a bit about your book, which is really such a tragic story. It's about a guy named Reggie Shaw. He killed two scientists about 8 years ago. He was texting and driving in Utah, where he lived. And at the time, he denied initially that he was texting. But nonetheless, I mean, the story has, I won't say a happy ending, but he sort of comes to his senses when it comes to his understanding about the dangers of texting and driving. What should we take away from this story?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. You just said that beautifully. I wish I had that elevator pitch when
to
sell it.
Oh, wow.
A few things to take away. One, this is really an all-American kid and a remarkable human drama in that he knows the difference between right and wrong. He's driving in the dark in freezing rain at 6:30 in the morning and nevertheless is texting some innocuous message to a young lady he barely knows when he slips across the yellow divider and kills two people. So one thing to take away is that this is not some negligent or inherently negligent person. He is all of us. And the second thing to take away is what Reggie came to learn through an historic prosecution, a really first of its kind incident, and a wrenching drama in this part of the country, was he came to learn the science. In effect, we come to understand what happened inside Reggie's brain, and what we begin to take away is what's happening inside our brains as we interact with our devices.
So what is happening? And this would be devices either, you know, texting going off or the phone ringing or some kind of pinging or some kind of noise. How does our brain resonate with that?
Yeah, let me do a little bit of neuroscience 101 and just say also, this does relate to the conversation you just had. I think the texting and driving is the canary in the coal mine. That's where these effects become deadly. But what I'm about to describe is happening all the time in lots of settings, at the dinner table, at the airport when your previous guest was on the airplane. There's a reason we're in our devices all the time, and let me explain a little bit how it works.
Sure.
The most resonant analogy for me is to picture a cave person sitting in front of a fire. And I know this sounds far afield, but bear with me for a minute. The cave person gets a tap on the shoulder. And, of course, the cave person is going to turn around because he or she doesn't know, is this someone with food, a potential mate, or worse yet, someone with a spear. You have to turn around. Now, when you're in the car or any place and your phone rings, it's a proverbial tap on the shoulder from anyone, anywhere in the world. It's hard to ignore. And now let me just tell you what's happening inside your brain at that moment. The cave person tending to the fire is using the most advanced part of the brain. It's called the prefrontal cortex, and it's aptly named. It's right in the forward part of the brain, forward part of the head, and it's responsible for art, architecture, civilization, anything that requires our attention, the most evolved part of the brain. But when the tap comes on the shoulder or there's a roar of a lion from behind, what it does is send a signal from the reptilian parts of the brain, our survival instincts, sends a message to that front part that says, lion, run or die. Same thing is happening inside the car, Marty. When you are driving and using your attention networks to focus on piloting a missile down the road, as Reggie was, but a signal comes and says, bring, it hijacks that attention network and says, quick, answer the phone. You don't know if it's opportunity or threat. It is, as I say, in effect hijacking those higher networks of the brain. Hard to ignore.
Well, and this reminds me of classes I took years ago, psychology classes in college, where we learned about intermittent reinforcement, which is that is the hardest behavior to extinguish, because every now and then you get something good, even though most of the stuff that you get is something you're not interested in.
You're five steps ahead of me. That's great. And may I just expand on that point?
Please
for a
do.
Second?
Yes.
So this goes back to B.F. Skinner another just quick image to give you. The classic experiment here is there's a rat in a cage, and the rat presses the lever all the time, a food lever, and doesn't know which press of the lever will bring the food. And so the rat becomes habituated or conditioned to press the lever all the time. What scientists are saying now is that the smartphone acts on exactly the same system. You never know when the good stuff is going to come, the important email, the thing that's actually urgent. And so you're conditioned to press it all the time. And here's one of the fascinating perversities, if you will, that I learned for this book, is that you would think, if your cell phone gave you a lot of spam, which it does, that it would make it less magnetic. In fact, it makes it more magnetic, more habituating, even addictive, because you never know when the good thing's going to come. It is a slot machine in your pocket.
And I think that analogy is really interesting because, again, the slot machine you mostly lose, but there is that occasion when you all those little bells go off and you get your, $50 or something.
You get your $50, and the comparison here is not you don't get $50. You get what the scientists refer to as a dopamine squirt, a little burst of adrenaline. And I think that your listeners, if they're anything like me, know the feeling where you sort of get the Jones for a little bit of action from your cell phone, and you're constantly checking. So what winds up happening, and again, this is adding yet another layer to the habituating nature of this thing, is that you, or this thing being the device, what you do is you get a little dopamine squirt, you get a little dopamine squirt, and then in its absence, you start to feel bored. And what it creates is this reward cycle that actually, Marty, has very little to do with the information, but just has to do with the mere mechanics of interacting with your device. I just saw a study or a quote a stat come out in the magazine The Week saying that we check our devices 150 times an hour a day.
No.
That struck me. Yeah.
150?
Yeah, it struck me as low, actually, but but regardless, let's just say it's in the ballpark. It means that all the time, I would defy anyone to tell me they get 150 important messages a day. Maybe not even one. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells you we got this slot machine in our pocket, as you describe it. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Matt Richtel. He's a reporter for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for his series of articles on distracted driving. He has a new book called A Deadly Wandering, and it's subtitled A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. We are talking about inattentive driving and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at WHY. Y.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. More and more, I notice new cars are just, you know, full of bells and whistles. And yes, you know, you don't have to use your pick up your cell phone and talk on it, but it's all sort of built into the car system. Are we building cars that are just more and more distraction machines?
I mean, that's what the scientists who look at this would say is yes. What the automakers would say, and of course they've got a vested interest in saying this, is that people are going to do it anyway, so let's give them the quote-unquote safest way to do it. And that would mean things like voice activation systems or heads-up displays. And depending on heads-up displays, meaning the thing is right in front of you that you're looking at rather than having to look in your lap. The early research says two things about these infotainment systems. It says that maybe over time there will become a way to make these safer. It also says that at present these are actually making things more dangerous. And I hate to laugh, but some of the research is very, for want of a better word, is a little bit funny, because what happens is these voice activation systems are so badly built that what you wind up doing, in effect, is arguing with your car. So one of the researchers said to me, a researcher who figures prominently in this book, whose life intersected enormously with Reggie, the protagonist we discussed earlier, but he said at one point we had a study subject who was telling the car to turn up the heat, and it turned up the volume on the radio.
So, the cars are taking over the world. Yes, we know
the
that.
The cars are taking over the world. I mean, you know, there's a line I've stolen this from someone, and I can't remember who. Or I would credit this person, but the self-driving car may come before we actually peel ourselves away from our devices. This person said, well, we got a better shot at taking the car out of the hands of drivers than the phone out of the hands of drivers.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So who knows?
But help me understand, why is it then not distracting if you're driving a car and someone is sitting next to you and you're having an animated conversation? Or is it just as distracting as talking on a cell phone?
Yeah, great question, and this was one of the very first questions I asked myself and learned yet another surprising thing here. In fact, Marty, when you have a passenger next to you, it enhances your safety, and the reason is because that person acts as a second set of eyes on the road. So what they wind up saying is modulate their conversation. They go, it's rainy, let's be quiet, or look out for this. And then if you're, you know, the joke here is if you're a spouse, you know that you can't wait to tell your
spouse. Well, don't go there now.
Right, that's in a whole different hour.
Exactly. I have another question for you. There's this thing called, I don't know if it's the actual scientific term, called highway hypnosis, but I think we all know where you get in your car. It's a very familiar route. You drive the route, you get home, and you say to yourself, how did I get here? And chances are, we stopped at red lights. We didn't run over anybody, and we, you know, weren't driving like hellions. And yet we don't have that kind of moment-to-moment memory of it.
Yeah, no, you're bringing up indirectly a really good point. I hadn't heard the term highway hypnosis, but it stands to reason. I mean, I'm going to use a different word here. I'm going to use the word boredom. And it's the relevancy of that is that, you know, driving often doesn't seem that interesting, which is why we're replacing the experience or complementing the experience with any number of things, the radio, but now these hyper-advanced devices. And, you know, it feels like, well, I've driven this route a bunch of times. I can handle this. And, in fact, here's what winds up happening. A lot of people text and drive, and they, if you will, get away with it.
Yeah.
Or talk on the phone and dial and get away with it. And they do it, let's say they do it 100 times, and they say to themselves, well, 100 times I've done this, and 100 times I haven't gotten in an accident. I was bored. This was more fun than driving. If I did it 100% of the time and got away with it, therefore it's not dangerous. It's what the scientists would call a small sample size and a really bad one. And what happens in driving is every once in a while you get a very small margin for error. In fact, all the time you have a very small margin for error, but sometimes it's minuscule, as it was for Reggie on a dark road in the freezing rain and the people he collided with. And when you are lost in your phone or in an animated conversation with someone who can't say, look out, there's a truck coming, and you have no margin for error, that's when the deadly consequences happen. So just to go back to the beginning of your question, yeah, we're kind of bored when we drive. You have to ask yourself a question. What is my responsibility behind the wheel? I am driving a missile, and there are other people, maybe with kids in the back seat. How much attention do I owe the road? I think most of us would say, if really pressed, I owe it a lot of attention. But because we feel bored and because there is an alternative right now in the form of hyper-advanced cell phones, almost with supernatural capabilities, it's hard not to participate with them.
And about a minute before we have to say goodbye, I want to go back to Reggie Shaw, because now he has really become an activist, warning against texting and driving. You describe some of the talks or speeches he gives at schools, and it sounds, you know, very moving, very personal, obviously very tragic.
Oh, it's just incredible, Marty. I've previously written novels. I have not have had the audacity to invent this character. He goes from creating a tragedy to denying it for 2 years to becoming the center of a historic case to then redeeming himself and saying, I did it. And he says, I did it because he learns the science. The science that we've described here intersects with Reggie, and he says, he gets on his knees in front of audiences, anyone who will listen to them, and he begs them, please don't become me. And as a result, he's called an American hero by no less than the Secretary of Transportation. And just to go back to your very first question, what do we learn from this?
Right.
Well, he offers us not just the example of someone who succumbs to his device, but someone who learns to create boundaries. And in that way, he's a proxy for tragedy and redemption and maybe a way out.
Well, Matt Richtel, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a reporter for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for his series of articles on distracted driving. And his new book is called A Deadly Wandering, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to post on our Facebook page Werner Herzog's PSA. It's quite moving. It's called From 1 Second to the Next, and it has to do with distracted driving and texting. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out about Facebook and Twitter, our weekly newsletter, and how to download a podcast of the show, and much, much more. Quinn Lipson, the intern this fall for Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer today. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.